sitting here with Professor Jack Z. Bradich. He's a professor of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University, and we're talking about his book from 2022 that's had a bit of a resurgence over the last year called On Microfascism, Gender, War, Death from Common Notions. And before we talk about the idea of microfascism, which we talked about on the show years ago with Natasha Leonard, but and we'll give people a refresher on this idea of microfascism. Before we talk about that, you are a professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey, as was another anti-fascist scholar, Mark Bray. And he was in the news recently because he fled the country. I didn't read too much into that. I've read Mark Bray's anti-fascist handbook and appreciate his work. But yeah, what's the story with that? What happened with Mark Bray?
Yeah. Mark's a pal and a colleague. And, you know, about 3 weeks before this even happened, I ran into him in the halls. He was going to teach his class. I was going to teach mine. And so, you know, he blurbed my book too. So I've known him for some years. And basically what happened was the Kirkians, the Turning Point USA chapter of Rutgers, basically kind of inherited a list from, I think, the kind of older Horowitz, was it Viewpoint, the kind of site that targets enemy combatant intellectuals. And so there's a list of like seven folks, and Mark is on that list. And so they, because it was right after the designation, the terrorism designation of Antifa. And so he has a book with that title, in it. And so they found it, they asked for him, they sort of like started, you know, I think network swarming him in order to get him to get fired. And then the death threats came. And so, before, you know, I mean, it seems like the administration didn't know how to handle this. So he, of course, feared for his life, and the life of his immediate family. And so, yeah, they fled the country, and now he's teaching remotely from,
All right. So he's still teaching at Rutgers, but he's just out of the country.
Out of the country and, yeah, teaching online.
Is there like a campaign to bring him back in some way? Or is this just, he's just like letting people know I'm getting away from this harassment?
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see in the spring if there's a comfortable enough environment for him to return. The university, as they often are, was pretty slow to respond. And now, you know, they might have a task force or some kind of way of thinking about faculty that might be under threat. So it remains to be seen, like, if he'll be back anytime soon or, you know, might not be till next year. Who knows?
All right. It's a bleak situation, but you're doing okay? You're not facing the same harassment?
No, and I feel like, I'm not on that list of seven. The list of seven includes people who are no longer at Rutgers, so I'm not even sure where they're getting all this info, but I thought I might be in, you know, I mean, it's funny, when Mark was leaving the country, I was already in Spain for a conference and kind of that same weekend flying back. And I was like, am I going to get harassed at the, you know, at the border? I wasn't, though. There was a strange moment with the, with border control that repeated the word Rutgers. He asked me where I taught, and I said Rutgers. And he was like, Rutgers. And then he handed my passport back
to me. That's a fun word to say.
And Rutgers. Maybe that's exactly it. Maybe it's just like, it was just a game for him. But anyway, yeah. So, but no, my joking way of thinking about it is that when they do searches, when the right does searches, like, they don't look inside of a word. So like fascism, if fascism is the title of your book, they might flag something. But microfascism, it's not the beginning.
Yeah, it's so, too long.
Yeah.
Are you hurt that you're not on the list? I kind of wish that you got some, what am I doing wrong
here? Exactly,
I can't get death threats?
Yeah. I don't teach a class on it, so maybe that was part of the difference. But yeah, no, I kind of, it's like a club that I kind of want to be part of, but not the death threats part.
All right, well, you know, sticking with this kind of Antifa scare or whatever, the black scare, I don't know, red scare type thing, you know, we haven't seen the worst of it yet. We've talked about it a bit on this show, but It you know, as someone who's been writing about this and following anti-fascism for a long time, as we both have, it's very interesting that Antifa was like a real street presence in the first Trump administration. After Charlottesville, it kind of fades away along with the alt-right, at least from like public display, these sort of confrontations in cities, and people kind of start forgetting about it. You know, we don't, there's not the same, there wasn't the same sort of panic about Antifa coming to your town after 2020. Mm. And Trump kind of just revived it after Charlie Kirk. Like, I was kind of hoping he just forgot about it. Yeah. And it's kind of obvious why he did that, right? But why do you think we aren't seeing a lot of anti-fascist groups, or, you know, we're seeing people struggle against ICE, and we're seeing like the No Kings March, and, you know, we're seeing some like things that look like the resistance to Trump 1.0, but we're not seeing the same kind of ninjas.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, sometimes ninjas have to retreat and reform and figure out new modes of expression, I would say. So whether or not we consider the, you know, the Portland Frog figure, you know, the kind of return of a certain version of this. So it might, some of it might be not taking even the visible form of even something that was as amorphous as Black Bloc or Antifa, right? It's just like the idea that things might be happening, things might be, you know, going on, but they're not going to show up in the same way. So, I mean, there are different kinds of shadows for ninjas probably to move through. And so I don't think it's gone. It's just like, it's probably, well, I imagine regrouping, reintegrating into things that are already happening might be an interesting way to see that. Yeah,
there was this Fox News bit when the LA riot was happening in June against ICE. Mm. Where they were like, all right, you know, this looks like a bunch of normal LA people rioting, but don't be fooled. That's Antifa. Antifa just like changes their outfits, changes their cause, you know, goes from one thing to another, but it's still the same people who do the Palestine occupations and the George Floyd uprising and Stop Cop City and all that stuff, which is, you know, more or less correct. Although I also think that there's a bit of, you know, my theory, and I'm working on a project about this too, is my theory is it's not just like Antifa are changing their causes and their outfits, but also anti-fascism was a kind of thinking and tactic that made a lot of sense up until around 2018. And so there's actually a theoretical progression. It's not just aesthetic. It's not just hiding. What do you think about that?
What would you say that the theory is because... because fascism has taken hold, that it doesn't take the same...
I read this interview with Three Way Fight and Shane Burley. Mm. Three Way Fight is one of my favorite anti-fascist theory collectives, I guess you could call them. And they were talking about Antifa in Trump 2.0, right? And Shane Burley said, you know, I've heard from a lot of anti-fascist people I've known over the years that we don't have a three-way fight anymore because... these alt-right people are just working for the Trump administration, or they're like doing media basically for the administration. And so now it's a two-way fight. It's just Antifa versus the state. So I think that might be a part of it. That is like, it doesn't make sense to like go after like swipe MAGA hats anymore, or like try to find who's alt-right in your neighborhood or whatever. Or deplatform, because you can't deplatform the federal government, you know, unless you have like a revolution. And then I think the other part of it is just sort of basically what you're getting at in this book is that on some level, this is a problem not just of like one far right cohort taking control, but also the subjectivity that produces it on a level that's far deeper than anything you can just deplatform or fight, you know, the subjective level.
Yeah. So I want to... since the book is mostly about the second, I do want to mention something about the first, which is it might be a temporary two-way fight, but pretty quick. I mean, we know that the state is not some, even in its policing functions, even its kind of militarizing functions, isn't always coherent and unified, that at some point elements of these of the FBI, which has been so hot on chasing like incels for a while and defining the far right, I mean, there might be elements of the security state that's still going to be even if they're slightly pacified now, will be reactivated. So I think right now there is a kind of integration of the two way, the other two enemies into a particular part of the state. But I think we can't forget that there's still the kind of centrist liberal forms of security that can be activated at any time.
Yeah, that's exactly how Three Way Fight responds to this. Yeah. Is essentially like there might be this appearance of unity, but there's always going to be fractures, fractures within the capitalist class, fractures within the ideological right. And we're seeing that right now with this sort of like Nick Fuentes taking the position or taking the role of Charlie Kirk and using anti-Semitism as a way to be system disloyal to the Trump administration. So
yeah.
So the third pole is like reemerging again.
Yeah, exactly. And I think and I also like three-way fight folks. And Matthew Lyons is someone I rely on around his gender critique, which comes out of that for me is really crucial. So I try to think of that as well. So I appreciate that about that component of a kind of more visible state organized the forms of violence and fascism that we counter. The other part you're mentioning, which is a bit more linked to something that we might call microfascism or fascism in everyday life, or the ways that no matter what forms the police take and the state takes, there's a substratum that so much of this is built upon, which is the everyday production of subjectivity. And for me, it's specifically, the dimension of gender has been the one that's been my sort of point of focus for a while, because I find that it is mutating but also still gives us a portal into understandings of fascism, both historical ones, the interwar period, but and especially the kind of contemporary reconstitution of fascist masculinity today.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about that, because this, hatred of women or this like drive to destroy women as part of the death drive is a big part of the book. And I want to get you to explain that a bit better. But before that, we should just maybe get into some definition of terms. Mm-hmm. So microfascism was coined by Gilles Deleuze and Guattari, or
I think it's primarily Guattari,
okay.
Who doesn't get enough credit in the duo. But in this case, I think he coined it and he elaborates it more in other essays than Deleuze ever did.
Okay. Yeah. I first became familiar with it from Foucault's introduction to A Thousand Plateaus. And at first I was like, oh, Foucault coined it, but no, it was Guattari and Foucault was working on it. And it's a project of tracing, quote, the genealogy and the permanence of certain fascist machineries in order to refuse and allow any fascist formula to slip by on whatever scale it may manifest, including within the scale of the family and even within our own personal economy. So this is, I should say, this is defining a project of opposing microfascism. So what was the historical context in which D&G and Foucault were working on this concept?
Right. So we're talking about a moment. That's a really great quotation. I like that too. I want to flag scale in that too in a little bit. But yeah, so they're working in the post-68 moment where the left, especially the French left, is understanding, trying to figure out desire, right? And just to figure out a way to think about power and its relationship, sometimes to pleasure, but often with to desire. And so so this concept, I think in the Foucault's preface is something like, the fascism in our heads. So the idea is that fascism is not just the thing that arrives in ways we expect it to arrive in these mass scales with uniforms, with a fully formed state, or even really a party, or even really a kind of organization that's easily identifiable with its symbols and its, again, its uniforms. But it might be something that begins at the level of desire itself. And where do we find desire? We find that in everyday life. So Deleuze and Guattari's project, one of their projects, is about what they call the social organization of desire. So desire is not just some psychological thing or it's not inside of us, but it's always arranged, always socially constituted and given forms of expression and spaces to elaborate. So for them, this is the moment of turning to Deleuze and Guattari at some point call it it's like the SS officer who's on your block also, meaning like somebody who wants to rule a domain. Again, the family unit is very important to Guattari, especially when he's working on these questions of the capitalization and patriarchalization of desire inside of nuclear families. So it's a turn, I think, to one of the things I like about French theory generally is like they come out of a moment, a long moment, right, of the French Revolution, which saw a revolution quickly turn into terror. I think that change has marked so much of French political thought, especially in the 20th century when it came to the Soviet Union, and I would say with fascism. So the idea is like, oh, we might have vanquished this particular kind of fascism, but what's always lurking is another possible one. And this is the thing we need to be attuned to, rather than just, you know, bask in the victory of defeating an enemy.
That's a really important historical context, because we sort of forget that in post-war Europe, especially, but also in the United States and in the Soviet Union, anti-fascism was sort of the logic of the post-war order. It's like we're justifying everything in terms of how we rebuild it, in terms of how power is restructured, in making sure fascism can't happen again. And so you had these like leftist popular front governments in Europe, and you have the Berlin Wall being called the anti-fascist separation wall and that sort of thing. And so it kind of makes sense in like a post-68 moment to say like, okay, fascism is defeated, but what about the kind of latent fascism within society? But this leads to something that I was, I think, previously confused about before I read your book, or maybe you've got a different take on it, especially from reading Natasha Leonard's book, Living an Anti-Fascist Life, which talks about microfascism. I had this impression that the concept was more about manifestations of fascist-like behaviors and dynamics, something more like microaggressions than the project of someone like Wilhelm Reich or Adorno looking at the mass psychology of fascism, or the authoritarian personality, like how fascist movements and groups emerge on the individual scale. So are one of those more close to your thinking, or do you think it's a combination of the both?
You know, it's interesting because like one of the ways I often, when people ask me to define microfascism, I use the example of microaggressions. But what I use it for is also to say, we're not just talking about, you know, small scale individual acts. We're talking about an environment of hostility that microaggressions produce. Or the other example I use is, or the analogy is like, it's not about microbes as individualized units, but a microbiome, again, a kind of ecology or an environment. So it's a little bit of both, insofar as it's about the individual, relationship of the individual to this system, right? And so yes, it's about it's the desires that animate, for instance, authoritarian personalities in the family, which I think is something that, Natasha would also probably lean towards in that kind of the desire in everyday life. But it's also a scaled dimension for me, which gets into why microfascism to me is also about the production of collectives. It's a kind of collective subject, not just an individual's desire in relation to their everyday interactions, but there's something about the scale that is no longer a mass, but a network that matters when it comes to microfascism. So I'm not sure if that's getting at the kind of way you're...
I think I understand. So it's like, you know, microaggressions are part of it, or like microfascism can express itself in microaggressions. But then you also think that that sort of environment where those things are tolerated or encouraged or fostered leads to the creation of networks that obviously in the past few years we've seen it lead to a pretty powerful... different kinds of movements, including like stochastic terror movements just through Discord, or the alt-right is another example of this, right? So this is why, this is kind of like maybe why your book has seen a bit of a resurgence between 2022 and now.
Yeah. And just to go back briefly to the Wilhelm Reich one, I mean, I think the older models still operated, the scale was individual to a kind of leader figure, right? There's the Führer, or some kind of leader figure, and then that just gets replicated downwards. Whereas for me, so there's something that's happened more recently, and we can get into, you know, the word groupuscular too, which is Roger Griffin drawing off Guattari, about fascism forming not in that kind of structure of sort of, you know, trickle down almost like repetition of leader to like family household head, but there's something that happens across the ways that peers begin to develop their own units that gather and the desires that are there. So we can talk about that in a moment. But I'll just go to answer your question about 2022 and why it's at no resurgence. Yeah, it was an interesting moment, right? I mean, books are always find themselves finding their own times, let's just say, or they're untimely and timely. Most of the book was written or researched in like 2018. It came out the very first week of 2022. We were trying to time it with Common Notions with a one-year anniversary of the January 6th riots in 21. So it came out then, and you know, it was still kind of a COVID book also. So like meaning books that were kind of released in early 22 were still, you know, there weren't that many activities and you know, surrounding them in terms of events. Anyway, it came out in a moment where I think many people thought, well, we don't have fascism anymore, right? Biden won. So Trump is basically kind of always in the margins. So I think it got a little bit of attention, but not that much. But then Trump 2.0 shows up and people are like, wait a minute, what happened? How did this happen? Not just as an electoral campaign strategy, but what happened to the society and culture? So I think that's one of the reasons people are like, okay, well, how do we make sense of this? And to be honest, I think the book arrived at a moment where people were still like scratching their heads, like, was it fascism? Is it fascism? It was trying to intervene in that discussion then in like the first Trump regime. Now people, I think, are like, well, okay, sure, it is. But what does that mean? How do we make sense of it? So I think it's sort of seen a little bit of some new attention in the past few months, or just at least since the inauguration here in the early 2025.
I'm sure some listeners are a bit lost. We're talking kind of fast. So let's talk about some like specific examples of what you see as microfascism or the production of it.
Right. Okay. So, So examples, I would say, well, the main example I use in the book, the reason why I chose gender, is because of the ways that prior to even something called the alt-right, what we saw is the rise of what now, you know, easily gets called the manosphere, but a ways that online there were a series of, you know, sometimes groups like men's rights activists, incels, pickup artists, but more than that was a kind of the proliferation of, you know, discourse and what I would say affects that were tied to online culture that became a kind of basis for, in addition to like a Trump victory, I would consider it the basis for feelings of, the pleasure in vanquishing an enemy, trolling, for instance, right? The pleasure in disrupting, affects around gloating and goading others into committing acts. Sometimes it was of suicide on 4chan, for instance. So these, whether or not we call those microfascists, you know, acts, to me, those were things that were bubbling in culture that produced what I would consider a kind of networked collective body that then could be moved into things like voting, into things just like, you know, doxing or harassing. So, as a concept, it's trying to pinpoint things that are emergent that don't always crystallize into form. Again, that sounds vague, but part of it is a kind of conceptual act of trying to get us to see things differently through a concept. The book is filled with examples, again, of like incels, pickup artists, other elements of the manosphere that I think are ways of tracing at least the gendered component in the U.S. mostly of a kind of emergent collective fascist body in the microsphere, in the cultural sphere, that then, you know, eventually I think resulted in something like, not the only reason, but, you know, resulted in a kind of statewide fascist formation. So I think that would be one example, just like a broad example. The manosphere is a broad example of a place where this was formulating.
Yeah, I don't think we have to get into a debate about, like, is Trump a fascist or not? Are we living under a fascist government or not? But absolutely, if we understand microfascism this way, the federal government is microfascist. They're doing these little, you know, dog whistles, and they're saying no more refugees of color, only white refugees. They're going after anti-fascism specifically as a way to destroy the entire left and political opposition. I mean, we could say that they're doing all of this to re-entrench neoliberalism or liberal democracy. We can theorize what they're actually trying to do, but clearly they're using fascist impulses and dog whistles and activists to do it.
Yeah. No, in fact, I mean, this to me gets at the, what, I mean, maybe we want to get to later, but what I would think is also the fragility or the volatility of this current fascist integration of the micro-fascism in it. Because you mentioned stochastic terrorism earlier. I mean, I think the way that this fascist state formation is running is a bit stochastic itself, right? I mean, it is chasing things. It's, as you said, like deploying things at a small scale level, like dog whistles. At the same time, it doesn't really have a kind of consistency or coherence in its operations. Anyway, we can get into some of that, but I do think that like the fact that Trump has to go city by city to try to even clamp down on this tells us that like there's a pretty large body of landed population that needs governing from their perspective, and they're not going to be able to do it in a kind of totality. So I mean, that's just a question of like logistics and social war things. But I know I've moved away from what you had said, but yes, I do think what's important is that now it's a little harder to find, to pinpoint all the microfascism, because it has become official culture in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the anti-woke, you know. And I watched this interview with Sydney Sweeney last night. I don't know if you saw that.
No.
It was just for her new movie, and she had this ad, like it was like an early kind of anti-woke versus woke moment in the Trump administration, where the ad seemed to be making a joke about eugenics. Mm-hmm. Like she's a blonde white woman, that she has the best genes.
Yep.
And they were asking her about it, and it was very hard for, and like people online are like, oh, she clearly is a racist, she's just playing dumb. And I was like, I don't know, she might actually not know about this, but importantly, she doesn't care. Like she doesn't think she needs to care. She doesn't feel like we're in a moment where she has to say, yeah, I'm not a white supremacist, I think that's disgusting. She can just say like, I'm not going to talk, I like genes, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that, I mean, that lack of care or the kind of indifference to this moment, I mean, to that kind of moment that she's expressing, is to me like something that has been, you know, cultivated and coordinated and circulated online around the kind of numbness that comes with, you know, power-driven trolling, right? The kind of like, oh, we can just be, you know, have no kind of sense of empathy with the other. We can, in fact, find joy or thrills in the cruelty, you know, out there. But in her case, yeah, it's this kind of wispy, like, well, you know, it almost doesn't, I'm not affected by it, so I don't need to say anything about it. And so I think that ability to detach and kind of float is already part of a certain kind of mood or vibe or a kind of practice of like distancing, right? Of a kind of detachment. That's what I was getting at, right? A kind of detachment from the moment, which itself, in a moment of crisis or harm that's being done, is itself, to me, a kind of fascist affect.
Mm. So yeah, getting back to the gender question, you write that the primary war, I assume, for fascists or microfascists, is a war of subjectivity, specifically a war on women. So explain how and why the hatred of women is at the core of microfascism. I'm obviously thinking of Gamergate here, but there's, you know, a million examples.
Yeah, Gamergate was the most kind of visible one at that moment, which had been, you know, predicated on a lot of cyber stalking and online harassment of women, you know, for years before that. But that really kind of crystallized it as a kind of, you know, gender-based misogynistic campaign. So yes, so that was like, and campaign is a key word, right? Because again, it's battle language, it's battle operations that are done online, right? We talk about brigading, we talk about these sort of war metaphors, but really they're actually kind of operations of war enacted in culture. So for me, yes, to go back to the wars of subjectivity, which is a phrase from Lazzarato and Allies in their War and Capital tome, where they say, you know, I mean, early capitalism is defined by wars of subjectivity. That is, it's precisely about vanquishing a certain kind of population or your enemies in order for other kinds of victorious institutions to arise. And they cite, like, I also, you know, really indebted to folks like Sylvia Federici and others who have talked about the war on women as the you know, the early witch hunts. So I take that moment of the understanding of the war on women as a kind of foundational moment for modernity, as something that we need to address, not just as the moment that it happened and then capitalism showed up and then we just have a different struggle, but that moment is reactivated again and again through culture in society. And so I'll leave it at that. Is that's the war on women is more central than it often gets placed. What I was seeing during this time of the kind of anti-fascist analyses, whether they were academic or not, I'm talking about in the mid 2010s, is that people acknowledged gender, and they said, like, misogyny is a gateway to fascism, or gateway to, you know, like the official forms of the far right kinds of power. But it was always a kind of portal or gateway or stepping stone. That was the other phrase, a stepping stone. And I was like, well, maybe it's more than a stepping stone, right? I mean, if we constantly are thinking about sort of stages, we might actually be not seeing the problem in its kind of complexity and the way that it's nonlinear in that way too. So I wanted to make sure that kind of war on women or the gendered component of fascism was given a little more attention than it usually is, where we often do have plenty of works that deal with capital, that deal with race, colonialism, as fascist precursors or as fascist, protagonists, sometimes antagonists. But for me, I wanted to give the kind of a pride of place in that sense, if you want to say it, analytically, to gender and see where that took us.
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying there, because there's like the sort of theory of the pipeline that, like, you get sucked in through Jordan Peterson, and then you go to Roosh V, and then you go to who's like the really big guy now? I forgot his name already.
Andrew Tate?
Yeah, and then you get a Tate, and then you're Nick, you know, whatever. There's this idea that there's a pipeline, but in a way, if you're getting into, if you're already like on 4chan and doing the Gamergate doxing stuff and playing that game, even if you don't like fully believe in it, or if you're just, you know, you're deeply lonely and resentful and you are drawn to a certain kind of pickup artist, you're already there in a sense. You're already in that milieu. And in fact, you might have been there kind of just before it. You didn't even need those ideas. Like, you were already, whatever came along first, you would have jumped onto it. And that makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know a lot of people in that, like, kind of incel pickup artist world, but I have seen friends over the last, 5 years or so, get really into, the two things that I've seen the most are transphobia. I haven't seen a lot of that, but, like, some friend just starts posting about women's sports a lot, often women. Cis women, and you know, you can just easily watch their timeline devolve towards Trumpism. It's not just they heard this argument, like, something was already there that got them there. And then the other thing would be COVID denialism. Obviously not all those people are far right or fascists. Some of them are, you know, and we don't have to go there. Like, it's a weird predisposition where they just, it's not about, like, they were convinced by something and they followed this, like, rational pipeline. There was just something already about them that made them just ready to enter this far right milieu.
Yeah, Andy, I think that what you just pointed to me is, like, one of the best sort of dimensions of microfascism, meaning, like, the best sort of articulated one, which is predisposition. Which, you know, what a predisposition is not always easy to pinpoint, right? It's like, it can be a convergence of things. It's socially produced, it's internally felt, but I do think, in particular, the predisposition, well, I'll talk about transphobia because I didn't talk about it enough in the book. But before I do that, let me just say, I think the predisposition, let's say in the 2010s, was a feeling by primarily young men, often white, not necessarily only white, who felt sort of victimized, who felt like they had been on the outs of what, of something in the world, and it turns out there was a kind of template for them to follow around who to blame, and before it was, you know, minorities and immigrants, it was, I would say before that, it's like easy to blame women, to blame, you know, the ascendancy, not just of women, but feminism in particular. So I think there was a predisposition to turn one's feeling of being rejected and find the one who is the cause of your feelings of rejection. Pickup artists do that very well. They show people how to deal with you know, finding those moments of rejection. Incels, of course, blame the entire world for that. But let's go back to the transphobia part, because I do feel like since the book was written, there's been more attention to that. And I wish I had written more about it, because the predisposition there, I think, gets at the core of what I think is this war that I'm talking about. And the kind of, this comes from me out of Marquise Bay's Black Transfeminism. And it's about that if we start with the premise that the world is filled with multiplicity, proliferation of expressions, identities, desires, then the original ordering principle is to take all that multiplicity, turn it into a binary, and then turn that binary into a hierarchy. We find that most often played out in and around gender, especially with transness, cisness. So transphobia, now to me, is like, this is why I think actually trans defense and trans expression and trans life is the one of the pivotal points for our kind of long-term activism, because it's the space of not just creativity but metamorphosis that gets at, to me, the arche moment of political order, which is the need to control the proliferation of difference and multiplicity, that then becomes something that is ordered through the gender binary. So I wanted to at least highlight the transphobia part. I think is so crucial today.
Yeah, and it's not only crucial today. You know, transphobia was a major part of the interwar fascist project, especially the interwar Nazi project. And you mention a book, Klaus Thevelite. Am I saying that right? Mm-hmm. Klaus Thevelite's mm-hmm. Male Fantasies, which is, it's interesting. I first heard of this book because some of the Dime Square scene was really into either, I don't know if they were reading the book, but they, like, one of these people printed out shirts of the book's very cool cover, and I thought, like, oh, this is some fascist thing. But then I saw some left-wing people talking about the book and saying it's really good, and I didn't read the whole thing, but I started reading it. I picked it up on my friend's shelf one day, and it's a great book. It's like sort of a ethnography of the Freikorps and the early Nazi party, the men of these groups and their sexuality. And it you know, you see a lot of their neuroses and their desires today.
Oh, yeah.
So go into a little bit about that book and how it relates to what you're talking
about.
Oh,
my gosh. If there's one book that I would suggest people read, is not mine. It's going to be Thevelite's two-volume set on it. The T-shirt is interesting, too, I'll just say, because I could see, again, a kind of right-wing version of reclaiming the idea that these are male fantasies and they're okay, that this is what we should be having or something. So, knowing Dime Square and its relationship to either irony but leaning right, I'm curious about that. But okay, so Thevelite, for me, methodologically, and the topic is just like incredible. So yeah, he studies, as you mentioned, Andy, the Freikorps, which are the kind of these warriors after World War One. These are the losers, right? These are the fail sons of World War One who were all energized to win.
And well, let's not call them fail sons just because they lost. Well, you know, it's not their fault.
Okay. Well, I mean, maybe the feeling is, I guess the feeling is like they are adrift. They no longer have.
They're ashamed.
They're ashamed, but they also, we'll give them shame. But I also think that they needed to still do the things that they were trained to do. Mm-hmm. So they still needed to exact revenge out there. Right. So that to me is like, I mean, depending on how we use the term fail sons, I mean, but the idea that the inability to complete one's mission now gets turned on others. So that to me was like the so he studies these guys, and so they're just like kind of wandering and you know killing and just like and like trying to figure out you know how to kind of reconstitute themselves. They become the kind of prototype for Nazi troops later. But in the meantime, what they're doing, yeah, he finds this treasure trove of diaries, of drawings, of poems that these guys are writing. And so much of it is about their fantasies of themselves as like these kind of armored, you know, heroic, impermeable beings. And then the women that need to not just like, you know, be beholden to them, but that are a threat to them, specifically a threat around and through blood. To me, one of the almost amazing insights, it gets to a microfascism moment, right? Where we often talk about like when like the Nazis talked about blood and soil. The blood tends to be about, you know, a kind of mythic, also eugenicist project. But he's pointing out that blood is also menstrual blood that terrifies these guys so much that they convert it into a bloody mess, the massacre. And so the blood of everyday life was also something in play around this social organization of desire. So it's he's such a beautiful writer. He finds these amazing artifacts, insights upon insights. So it's an incredible book. And
it makes me think of the Which Way Western Man meme, which is now, you know, our Department of Homeland Security is tweeting out variations of, which is this image of a, you know, a strong, white, strapping man. Where is he? He's not in a city. He's not, you know, in a factory. He's in some pastoral expanse. And he has these two choices, which is either this home where he's reigning as a singular sovereign. Presumably there's a wife and kids there over which he dominates, but we don't see them. They don't matter. You know, whatever happens in the home is his business. And then the other is like this haunted house, which I guess represents, you know, Rutgers University, like a postmodern degeneracy or whatever. Brutalist architect, whatever.
That's right.
So yeah, this, I think there's still at the heart of, you know, all of the irrationality of the fascist project, no matter if we're talking about the alt-right or Trumpism or whatever, there's this promise that, like, we're going to make you the sovereign. You're going to be on top. But that's sort of different from how fascism is usually defined, where you're a subject to the Führer principle. This is what Reich really emphasizes as, like, why the lower middle class is so drawn to, you know, the party and program of the Nazis. So do you think the microfascist explanation for this is it diverges a little bit from Reich's kind of psychological Marxist analysis?
Yes. And the reason is I think Reich was a great product of his time. Let's put it, you know, in terms of like a historical materialist analysis of the kinds of relationships he's examining. It's the age of the mass. It's the age of a leader and a mass of people that tended to be, or at least thought of as uniform. A mass is precisely the kind of uniformity, and this is why you have uniforms also, right? In the fetish of the kind of a repetition of symbols. I don't think we have, the primary relationship is not leader and mass. I mean, even if we take a despot like a Trump, like he doesn't operate in relationship to the masses. He operates through a relationship to both individuals that, you know, that sort of hear his voice, through networks and distributed form. But even beyond that, I think the leader function, even the right has talked about Trump not as a kind of Führer leader, but as someone who is a vessel, who is a vehicle for their own project. He just does some things that they hope he'll accomplish, right? So even the right understands like fascism no longer operates necessarily on that mass model.
Yeah.
So what else can we do? And so, but I think what you point up for me, the microfascism moment of understanding that is the idea now that we need to look more horizontally as a series of relationships, peer relationships, or slightly different hierarchical relationships. Andrew Tate, who we mentioned earlier, is a mentor and a kind of avuncular figure for these young men. He's not a kind of the same kind of like authoritarian father figure. There's a different set of, I would call them sibling relationships. And I'll just end by saying, and if you want to follow up on it, this is why now after the book, I'm thinking more about things like fratriarchy or the rule of brothers than a patriarchy, right? A kind of rule of the father that seems more obvious and more and closer to something like Reich's understanding of the household and the and individuals with leaders.
So if today's fascists, like today's fascist organizers or party leaders, you know, maybe people like Steve Bannon, I guess, going back to the first Trump administration, that's who we all kind of thought was like the ringleader of this. Richard Spencer, you know, these people sort of behind the scenes that we sort of think are the visionaries behind organizing these things, whether that's true or not. They had this theory that was weirdly, you know, they would openly say was rooted in Evola, who you call the preeminent cultural theorist of fascism, or the cultural dimension of fascism. And of course, they had this idea that politics is downstream from culture. And I've always disagreed with them and sort of thought this is kind of why their project's going to fail, because fascism might succeed, but it has more of a material basis and like declining prospects of the lower middle class and their own neuroses. But the culture isn't really what produces that crisis, although maybe it's meeting it halfway. But anyway, do you think that Evola or maybe his present adherents kind of have a point here, that culture is a way to organize these movements?
Yeah. I mean, I think my answer has to be yes, because the book wouldn't have been written otherwise. Evola, I will just say, there was so much focus on somebody like Carl Schmitt over the years of understanding fascism through a jurist and through, again, to understanding juridical order and again, important thinker. But what people who wanted to understand fascism missed is that kind of, not just the appeal of culture, but the place where you know, selves were formed in the place of relationship to traditionalism in the way that Evola talked about. So Bannon famously talks about, as do others, metapolitics, right? And some of them draw this from Gramsci also. You start in culture and politics is downstream from culture. Somebody like Bannon and the right at that point really saw this as a very specific organizing project, right? You're going to take elements that are being formed in culture and you move them, you shape them in the direction you want them to. These are strategists. This is what they do. And I think they were onto something. The part I disagree with is that culture can always just be a place that it can be strategized, weaponized, and contained. It's actually more elusive and more amorphous, and therefore also more resistant in the sense of you can find innovations in culture that don't always follow the commands of a strategist where they want to go. They can't be organized that easily. So yes, I do think that, I mean, microfascism as a book, I mean, I'm a cultural studies scholar. That's what I was trained in. So to me, politics is not separate from culture. There's something we call cultural politics, right? It's where power is elaborated through values and beliefs, hierarchies of selves, relationships, you know, those associations, so many things, not just representation and, cultural production of like images, but it's the space of the forming of the cultivation, if you will, of ourselves. So they have material dimensions outside of them, sure, but also there's a kind of persistence to culture that I want to get to through these ideas, not just microfascism, but Umberto Eco's Urfascism, that there's a long, long stream of, especially when it comes to gender, that is material, but not necessarily the kind of historical materialism that we associate with Marxist analysis, but is material nonetheless. Hence, going back to the war on women, going back to, you know, the witch burnings that are not just, to me, again, a stepping stone to capitalism, but it has its own long durée of history before, during, and after capitalism, potentially, as well. We have to be wary of, right? The war on women might continue after capitalism. And so we need to attend to it also as a material history. I mean, I don't know what's more material, to be honest, than the history of warfare.
Well, speaking of warfare, a central category in Thousand Plateaus and Deleuze and Guattari's work is the war machine. And I mean, that's something that I think, you know, a lot of the the lexicon on that book is like difficult to explain, you know, because it's sort of opaque to anyone who hasn't actually read it. And the war machine is one of those concepts. But I think not having read it in a few years, like stochastic terrorism is a pretty good example of the war machine. Do you think I'm on something there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because, I mean, it is one of the things I'm actually working on now after the book is a closer examination of the war machine and state relationship around fascism, because it's, I think, more complicated than Deleuze and Guattari, as complicated as they have it. But I think stochastic terrorism is certainly one of them. I'm trying not to get into the jargon too much.
Actually, let's start with the jargon because okay. I set this up without really defining what the war machine was. So what is the war machine when they originally use it? What are they trying to say with that category?
Okay, so from some at least part of my memory from reading that is that what they're looking for is like how do states emerge? What is the formation of a state? And one of the things the state does is what they say is overcode elements in its domain, land, taxes, people. So a state is defined by its functions, by its parts. So a war machine, they say, they often tie it to anthropological studies, Pierre Clastres, for instance, of societies against the state, that warrior societies or warrior elements of societies were actually there to ward off and preempt state formations from coming. So war machines, what they do, I mean, they still have objectives, victories, vanquishing, plundering, but they don't necessarily codify what they do. So they take this idea, this anthropological idea, and turn it into almost like these kind of principles and operations. War machines do not present themselves consistently. War machines, what they say is smooth out striated space. So striated space would be segments that things like states do. They divide things up, they put up boundaries. Whereas war machines create smooth space, right? They kind of, they tie it to the nomadic too, like nomads, they clear a space. And that sometimes can work to stop states from coagulating. However, states have learned how to incorporate war machines into them. This is why we have state militaries, they say. So it's like different from what we usually say is like a war machine, which is like, oh, the Pentagon's a war machine. But it, but it's a state militarization of a war machine that historically could remove itself from the state and turn on it, right? This is how often coups happen in states. So I mean, that's some of the kind of the general contours of the war machine state relationship. So for me, what I'm going back to and trying to look at how Deleuze and Guattari almost not necessarily romanticize the war machine, but they kind of create a fuzzy category, because what they say is like war machines rarely have war as their objective. Instead, it's about metamorphosis. It's about transforming, you know, and smoothing out that space. But then I'm like, well, why still call it a war machine? So I prefer Paul Patton, who's done some work, you know, I think Nicholas Michelson is his name, who've worked on the idea of the metamorphosis machine, which is sometimes tied to war, which is the war machine, and sometimes might have just metamorphosis built into it. For me, that's really appealing because this is what I'm drawn to when it comes to culture, when it comes to the idea, again, of gender and metamorphosis, of masculinity and initiation rites. How do these metamorphosis machines become war machines, which then allow them to also become closer to things like state militaries? And I will just say, some of these early war machines, they did, you know, they turned their enemies into slaves. They turned women into properties, into reproductive machines for themselves. So these war machines weren't all they were cracked up to be. So I wanted to at least highlight that part of their understanding too.
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe that's kind of why I forgot their sort of romantic view of the war machine in the book, because if I'm connecting it with stochastic terror, you know, maybe in my like vulgar memories of the book, it's because it seems like a good explanation of how young people, like the sort of terrorgram, like people who get drawn into these like dark, scary, satanic Nazi discords, either because they've been recruited or because they're just curious young people looking to see how fucked up they can get on the internet, which, you know, is a very common experience for young people. Yeah. And they find themselves in these discords where people are egging them on to commit school shootings, you know, shoot up a church, stuff like that. And so it seems like there is this sort of almost mechanic process of, like, you're diving into this world of evil desires and then coming out armed to lash out against society in some way that seems totally irrational, but it makes perfect sense in the context of your chosen community or the community that you've been sort of groomed into.
Yeah, in addition, for sure. And I think the difference now is not every one of those killers, and I'm thinking about Robert Cremo here, was the sort of Independence Day shooter in Chicago a few years ago, and I'll talk about him in a moment. But, like, they don't always believe. They don't always have a set of beliefs that they're even if they have a manifesto, that's not why they do things, right? That just seems very rational to have a manifesto and to say, like, this is what I believe. Cremo didn't have one, and he's called a post-manifesto shooter because he was trafficking in these, or he was, like, caught up in these discords and other sites that were doing what gets called schizo posting, right? I mean, again, the schizo is a really interesting, also draw from, you know, Deleuze and Guattari. I don't think they name it after that. But the idea here is to induce feelings of schizophrenia and experiences. So you're so detached from the world that anything can make sense, right? So the whole point is to sort of induce an experience, again, of dissociation. And then to have this kind of world of memes that then, you know, you inhabit. Cremo was like a rapper. He was an animation artist, or he drew some cartoons of himself, video maker, in addition to this. So the mass killing becomes just like a part of your performance, right? Part of your dissociated performance that now takes what you've done on the internet and embodies it in everyday life. And then you do it not for grand visions of a better, you know, like, you know, white supremacist world, but you do it to impress, you know, the guys in the Discord chat.
So yeah, getting back to this kind of tension that we were talking about between, like, the Bannon type people, the people who really do see MAGA leading to this kind of neo Reich, like this American Reich, you know, Trump's going to be the Red Caesar or something. We're going to overthrow democracy. But, you know, they're imagining setting up a new kind of state, right? A new kind of empire or something like that. And it seems like more or less this is what, you know, the Trump administration is attempting to do. But, you know, we also associate fascism not with, you know, we associate with this ambition of creating a 1,000-year Reich. I think Bannon has been saying like a 50-year Republican majority. So that's kind of more modest, but, you know, maybe he's just hiding his power levels there. Mm-hmm. But then we also associate it with the death drive, with homo suicidality that I think that you mentioned as an extension of that, of, you know, like this hatred of women turning into this fantasy of getting rid of all women and thus getting rid of all humanity, because you can't have humanity without people to give birth.
Yeah.
So yeah, when we're trying to think through the fascist moment, do you think it's both of these things and then they're in tension with each other, or they're sort of just driving each other? Or another way to put it is, like, you know, I remember the first Trump administration, there's this leftists were saying, oh, fascism is like the iron ring that holds together the decaying barrel of capitalism. And that's kind of an optimistic way of looking at it, because it's like, well, if we just get rid of that iron ring, then the barrel is going to fall apart and everything will be fine. But then, you know, what is the barrel containing? It's containing the social chaos. And so fascism is maybe in a way trying to control the death drive in a sense, or trying to manage it.
I mean, I love the image, because the image presumes like the barrel is like kind of like coherent and consistent, where if it's already being produced shoddily and through a kind of indifference, and maybe it itself is the result of a death drive, then it's already falling apart. I mean, I think the tension that you bring up, right? This like the long empire, I mean, what Trump is implementing is already the decay of that empire before it even really begins, right? So again, golden ballroom, people starving, right? It's like this is the thing at the end times of an empire, not at the kind of start of a long, of a long regime or a long reign. So I think there's something accelerated about this, something hybrid. The temporality of this fascism to me is fascinating in the sense of like it's already it's not just a harbinger of its future death, but it's like how much can it implement it before it actually starts falling apart. I mean, so I think there's something about that temporality, but I'm trying to get to something else you said too. The tension is that there's no more containment. I mean, even containment to me is such a 20th century notion. When we live in a world that is primarily a kind of networked, connective, fluid, communicative world, like the idea that these energies and these desires and these drives can be channeled even is like a major undertaking, right? The channel needs to be somewhat solid too. That's to me, it's not hopeful. It's just like almost an assessment of the enemy to say like, it of course is violent and lethal. Insofar as what I call it is like a downsurgency instead of an insurgency, right? It's a kind of, it's pulled into a vortex, a kind of homicidal, like indifference to life, indifference to its population. But it does that in a way that doesn't just take itself. It wants to take the world with it. And that's what makes it really dangerous. So I don't see it as like building, right? In the ways that even like, you know, the Thousand Year Reich had ideas of like, building for a future. Like the futurism here is, at best it's like, you know, a Muskian, failures to get to Mars, right? It's just like, which is also another kind of flight from life, right? A kind of fleeing. That fleeing is so constitutive of today's fascism, fleeing crises, trying to resolve crises by ignoring them, fleeing life, through a death impulse to, so I don't think it, again, the danger is not in its being successful insofar it's consistent and totalitarian, but that it's filled with a kind of what Deleuze and Guattari call a line of abolition. The line of flight that they talk about that enters the state becomes a line of abolition and takes society with it.
All right. Let's move to wrapping up. Talk about anti-fascism and anti-microfascism. And you write that any anti-fascism needs to be anti-microfascist. And, you know, anti-fascism has largely been understood in the U.S. context, at least, as various types of deplatforming, either online deplatforming or like Nazi rally in my town. Let's make sure it doesn't happen, you know. And you write that microfascism sort of challenges the approach because you can't, quote, deplatform subjectivity. So what are some examples of an anti-microfascist practice?
Yeah, so I think in the book there are a number of sort of areas and examples that I point out as possibles. And again, this was written mostly in 2019. But for me then, you know, the idea of the emergence of a care-based activism, care networks, the care collective was thinking through this, the emergence of something like ways that we connect our solidarity with also ideas of a kind of social reproduction. That is, that we, the idea that we reclaim forms of life away from the ways that, you know, fascism would provide us with forms of death or death styles. So, you know, I thought interesting places where like the ideas of metamorphosis and mutation were taking place were like the Institute for Queer Ecology. But the ways that, again, I turned here to almost like Latin America-based transnational feminism of folks like Veronica Gago and the idea of and the ways that they've been talking about something like re-existence, right? Not just protecting life as survival, but life as a kind of quality of proliferation of potential, potentia. And so what we're defending, so different forms of kind of community defense, which we've talked about, community defense, you know, and radical circles for a while now, but expanding those notions of community to also think about, well, it, as much as, you know, we're protecting kids, but we also want to not just protect kids in terms of being separated from their families. We want to protect kids insofar as they also want to express themselves through gender. We also want to protect people who don't necessarily want to have kids, or meaning like the things around questions around family abolition in Sophie Lewis's work. The idea that like the abolition that we're talking about is a different kind of destitution than the kind of exterminationism of fascism. We also want to abolish things, but we do that in order to free up life's potentials and the proliferation of possibilities in the ways we can make ourselves. So I find that within, again, transnational feminism, it's happening. I think that's it's happening in the again, the most visible one right now is the anti-ICE, street actions, which logistically I'd like to see, you know, a little more happening with that. But I also think there's something happening behind the scenes there. But also, I can't forget, even if it's not front and center, that the defense of the experimentation in gender around transness at all levels is important. These are scales. These are all different scales too that we need to examine.
You know, maybe one thing I think of when you're with that example of defending communities, defense, there's sort of a liberal idea, or like maybe the idea that the like left-wing mayors might bring out is like, we have to defend our community from ICE. And then maybe an anti-microfascist process is like, okay, yes, but also we actually do need communities. Mm-hmm. It can't just be about, we want to make sure we have this liberal diversity where everybody knows their place in the economy. We actually do have to care about what community means and make sure it's something better than just the standard capitalist divisions that inevitably lead to the emergence of different reactionary sentiments, whether it be from a right-wing organization or party or from a left-wing business owner who treats their workers like shit and is allowed to do so because there's a racial division of labor. So I mean, I feel like this is sort of the bridge between a liberal anti-fascism that is simply about defending the status quo and something that wants to really revolutionize society.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to me, the defense is always a defense of the kind of bubbling revolutionary experiments that need to be sort of like almost shielded from even, the liberal version of integrating all those into better consumerism, voting. Again, we're on the heels of, an exciting moment in New York City. But we also need to, keep those revolutionary energies of continuing to remain and become ungovernable, even with a better governor, right? A better governor in the sense of like a governing figure. We still need to retain those and not forget that. Because all of these moments of what appear to be anti-fascism can have this kind of liberal turn. This goes back to the three-way fight, right? They can always be found to reduce, to allow us to cope, to feel good about, temporary victories. Meanwhile, there's still a kind of lurking liberal centrist, state that's ready to kind of reconstitute itself and rehabilitate capitalism around it. So
yeah, normality, stability.
Yep.
All right. One last idea I had that I want to run past you is, we're talking about the pickup artists earlier. And I read one pickup artist book when I was a teenager. Some friend sent it to me and I flipped through it. And, I thought it wasn't like a particularly evil one, but I found it to be like kind of a mixture of like, good tips on how to start a conversation and how to have a conversation. And what I didn't like about it even though I was pretty young and didn't have a lot of experience with women, was like, there's this implication that you could sort of program a woman, that women are just these, you know, I don't know, like animals or robots that you can sort of trick into doing what you want. And I thought that was just kind of gross. But a little bit later, you know, when I was like more of a lefty college student, I read a book called The Ethical Slut, which people don't really talk about The Ethical Slut so much. I think it's maybe like fallen out of favor as part of like a cringy third wave feminism or whatever. But I remember that book was, among other things, you know, sort of like laying out the framework for what would become ethical non-monogamy and polyamory, I think before those were terms, was, you know, there was a chapter that was describing queer cruising culture. And it wasn't saying like, this is how you become queer or gay, or like, if you're a man and you want to hook up with a man, here's how you do it. It's like, this is how really good queer communities have sex and otherwise relate to each other in an amorous way. And it had a lot of the same tips from that pickup artist book, but it wasn't oriented towards deceiving someone or using someone. Wonder if like maybe someone could write an ethical slut for incels.
Yeah.
I'm sure someone's tried it, but like that could be a really good intervention where you could like say, well, you want to learn how to get laid? Here's some tips from like the queer world, you know?
Yeah. No, that's a really interesting proposal. And I'm sure there are, out of the kind of recent more hetero-pessimistic discourses, probably a little bit of like, well, it probably shouldn't have been guys telling other guys what to do, right? The advice, you know, that's part of the problem. Because inevitably, as you said, like women become instruments, even for the thing about, oh, how to feel confident or how to just feel like, you know, you can participate in society through a conversation. Like, you have to use a woman to get to that. The woman's role is a kind of non-consensual instrument for not just one's own pleasure, but a kind of one's own self-esteem as a dude. So is there a way? And yes, so I think the kind of queer cruising, I mean, I don't remember that chapter that well, but I think certainly the ways that consent discourse has come into play when it comes to dating and sexuality is so important. The idea that so much is actually talked about not as a seduction technique, right? But something that just says like, well, you know, these are also just forms of expression of how I'm feeling might be also a way to go. But yeah, so I think there's no, I'm glad we're kind of ending on this question of cruising and polyamory, because that to me is also a site where experimentation is happening about people trying to figure out not just like ways of loving, but ways of communicating that are focused on care of the self, care of others, and in ways that unethical sluttery or cruising was really about indifference to the other and just finding oneself's own pleasure. So I think it's a really great place to end, not just on that, but also the queer forms of kinship too. I think is also it would be a great place to look to the future.
And if you don't get laid, maybe you'll make some friends. What's wrong with that?
I just had a good conversation. Yeah. Like, but you know, what's wrong with that?
All right. We just had a good conversation.
Yeah.
Jack Z. Bradish on Microfascism, Gender, War, and Death is the book. Also check out The Ethical Slut.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks a lot.